Well, hello again, and welcome back to another Weber Training Teleclass. Perhaps I should say, welcome back to another Andy Streifel Teleclass. Our topic today is air and water sanitation for infection control and prevention. My name is Paul Weber, and it's my job to introduce our speakers and to say nice things about them. But Andy really requires no introduction. If you look in our recordings library on the website, you'll see that there are five of his previous teleclass lectures there, along with their handouts. Now, that's a free access area of WeberTraining.com. Just do a search with his name. He gave his sixth lecture a month ago, and here we are again. We get really large audiences for Andy's teleclasses. Even though they are what I would consider a niche topic, they seem to draw an awful lot of people, and he is extraordinarily popular. He's an audience favorite, and it is an honor again to have him back today. So from the University of Minnesota, to speak on air and water sanitation for infection control and prevention, I am pleased to introduce for his seventh and by no mean last teleclass, the one and only Andrew Streifel. Andy.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to listen to Paul introduce me, because he does come up with some very nice things to say about me. So thank you again. Our first slide today has to do with where I sort of grew up. I've been at this institution for somewhere in the ballparks of 30-some years, 40 years, I think. 1968, I came here and began working in 69 in the dialysis unit, and actually started my infection control career here in about 1977 or thereabouts. So it certainly has been a long and good process here, and today we're going to talk about some of the things that I've learned about air and water, and certainly by all means, it's not all inclusive. We're going to touch on some of these issues. The next slide shows a training program issue related to the Minnesota Department of Health. I received money to prepare this as a lecture for preparedness, in the sense of being ready for an infectious disease event. And what we've learned is that we need to use temporary negative pressure isolation for construction, as well as potentially isolating patients. We also need to know what kind of instrumentation will allow us to do some objective analysis, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about particle counts and some real-time sanitization checks that might be useful to some of you as it relates, again, to sanitation of body substances. And you'll see very shortly why that is a topic that will come out in this 60-minute presentation. The next slide has to do with what we want for goals, and that's understanding the role of the environment for infection control during infectious disease events. Now, what's an infectious disease event? Could that be a construction project? Could that be five patients walking in with some unknown set of symptoms that look like they're potentially infectious? Or what else could it potentially be? A flood, something along those lines. We certainly want to provide guidance for management of everyday disease processes. Again, these are things that we should be practiced in doing, and construction is one of those things. And by doing that, we prepare for that emerging infectious disease situation. Those objectives on the next slide, slide four, demonstrate we want to be able to demonstrate containment during these events. We want to recognize that some of those everyday things that we do, fix the leaky drinking fountain in the hall of oncology service, might be important to us, might be important in good infection control and prevention. Providing sanitation for training for body substances. My goodness, the symptoms in the hospital have a lot to do with body fluids and the discharge of those fluids. We certainly need to know how to clean them up. And when I ask around, there are very few standardized ways in which we clean up a patient discharge. Likewise, there are very few procedures, if you will, of cleaning up sewer backups, and we'll certainly talk about that. I'm sure some of you are experiencing that today as we discover what causes sewers to back up in our facilities. And again, one of the things that's so important is that validation that we have a sanitary environment, that things are clean, and we can then move forward with safe patient care. The next slide has to do with what we got out of environmental infection control, and if you've seen my presentations in the past, you know that I will comment on those airborne spread microorganisms that we know beyond a doubt, and I won't spend a lot of time with this table here today because those of you who have heard me know that Aspergillus is a big deal and that TB is a big deal, and some of the other diseases, while they're on the list, don't happen that often. So we're always afraid of those emerging diseases, those diseases that we don't know how they're spread, again, recognizing that we know how disease process works, but yet we need to interrupt that, and we need to be able to have a plan to do that particular aspect of infection prevention. And if the next slide is any indication of what we do with the fact that we used to cover our supply ducts, again, a standard slide for me, this is truly a disservice to the comfort of the patient as well as the employee having to put on PPE if, in fact, this is a patient that has some potentially infectious disease that could be airborne spread. So we certainly don't want to do that. We want to be able to take care of patients in a way that's meaningful in their convalescence because we could be one of those patients. The next slide has to do with a hospital survey. We published this article in the American Journal of Infection Control in 2007, and it amounts to a performance assessment of airborne infection isolation rooms. We, again, received money to get the state's hospital rooms that we consider airborne infection isolation up and working properly. We felt that the way to do that was not only to do a paper survey, which said we had this many rooms, but then to follow up at individual hospitals and have a peek at whether or not these rooms were actually functioning as airborne infection isolation rooms. And you can see that we looked at 678 rooms, and from the criteria that was established by the American Institute of Architects as well as the Centers for Disease Control with so much pressure and self-closing doors and that sort of thing, it came back pretty much that there was inadequate pressures on most of the rooms. The filtration analysis was quite shocking in that we found that the filters were, in fact, not properly installed in many, many hospitals. This is something I've seen nationwide and one that is quite appalling, especially when you think that we spend $20,000 to install a filter bank and then we don't make sure that it's working properly. And again, this is due to spacers. They buy filters that aren't quite the same size as the ones that they previously had, and you end up with filters that don't work. In addition to that, there's a lack of written plans, and certainly those are always important because if we don't have something to read and understand how we're going to do things, the next slide essentially tells us that we're not going to maintain a way in breaking that chain of infection, depending, again, on what we're dealing with. Some of these diseases, of course, aspergillosis, are somewhat exotic. They are becoming more prevalent on a worldwide basis from what I have seen, and we certainly want people to understand how you can break that chain of infection getting rid of that mode of transmission potentially, or even keeping that reservoir under control. Source management is really the name of the game and one that we should really deal with. And then when we think about the next slide, breaking the chain of infection, we can do that if it's an airborne spread microorganism by providing some kind of negative pressure isolation. And that's important during the construction project or even isolating that tuberculosis patient. When we deal with sanitation, we certainly need direct removal of that infectious pathogen. And if, like we had this last weekend, a major flood in our facility, Quite a bit of the from that end of the building is where a lot of our Clostridium difficile patients lie. We need to make sure that we clean that environment up and clean it up, get rid of that reservoir and try and, in fact, inhibit the growth if, in fact, that gets some sheetrock wet, which, again, might promote mold growth. Our healthcare facilities have some infectious disease management principles in the next slide. And we all know that administrative controls, if you don't have the folks on top saying this is how we're going to design the policies we're going to use, the procedures and the training methods are there. We can't do much with engineering controls. Our engineering controls are very important in that we need to have some hand cleansing, some surfaces that are cleanable. We need to make sure our ventilation specification is clear so that it's designed properly. So often in many hospitals that I visit that want some advice on commissioning is they didn't think about it early enough to make sure that that's what you're going to get as a deliverable. And those are the performance specifications. They're hard to find in the master spec often, but yet if we don't have that specified in a way that the contractor understands, it won't be there when we come when it comes available, and that sometimes causes very costly delays in moving into your healthcare facility. Self-closing doors, again, sustainable construction. Can we maintain that? Are the filters accessible? Are all part of what we need to know. And, of course, personal protective equipment is our right to know what kind of protection we may need when we are dealing with some kind of hazard. Remembering, of course, that hospitals are truly environments of controlled hazards with the radiation, with the electrical, with the chemical, as well as bloodborne pathogens, various infectious diseases that we need to think about. On the next slide, what does it take to know if it's working? What do we need to know? And there we need to talk about some of that ventilation management. What is it that we need to make sure that we get rid of that infection control certainty? And that evidence so often is ventilation parameters. We want to make sure things are working properly. Why is it in the literature when we look at disease outbreaks that there's some kind of some engineering deficiency or a lack of containment, be it the patient walking up and down the hallway, not contained, or the fact that the room is blowing instead of sucking. We need to be aware that uncertainty is gone, and that's why we validate, and I wrote an editorial in Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology in around 2000 that discussed the need to make sure that you do have some kind of analysis, objective analysis, that validates your airborne infection isolation rooms or your construction projects that we do on a regular basis, so that we know from experience that they work, because we're checking them. We're evaluating either visually or through the use of some kind of objective tool. And sanitation can be done the same way, because there are tools now, which we will describe shortly, that will help and assure the cleanup of body substances. When we look at ventilation as one example in the definition of term slide, we need to make sure we understand certain terms. And negative pressure, of course, is air from clean to dirty. We want air to flow towards the isolated infectious agent, usually in a patient or, in the case of a construction project, the demolition that's going on in that space. We want to make sure we understand that when we have a good air change rate, in other words, removing a fair amount of air, that we get a very nice reduction in particles. With each air change rate, if you have good mixing, theoretically you get 66% reduction. So you can see that rate would get chewed up very quickly, and with 10 to 12 air changes an hour, you can pretty much reduce by 90% the number of particles in the air within 12 minutes. Filtration efficiency, again, removal, the rate of that helps us in interpreting data, because a 90% efficient filter, which is what hospital filters are rated at, should remove somewhere around 90% of the particles, and those droplet nuclei In some studies I've just read that came from NIH in the last day, yes, there is a fair amount of containment of microbes in those droplet nuclei, and that inhalation transmission occurs up to 6 feet or 2 meters from the patient. So we are defining areas where we can get spread, and we need to know what we can do to manage that. And the next slide, with the purpose of temporary negative pressure isolation, we want to be able to meet some kind of surge capacity, we call it. Many patients being isolated, or a large area project being isolated for infection control. And we do that preventing of spread by maintaining a certain pressure relationship. 2.5 pascals is one that has been in the literature for a few years. Again, it is not evidence-based as much as we would like it to be, and what we are finding now is that in order to really contain particles, even with a door open up occasionally, we need somewhere close to 7 pascals. This was a very effective way in which we have demonstrated at this institution in some studies that we've done that 7 pascals does a very nice job of keeping gas as well as particles contained. That dilution ventilation, again, what we talked about earlier, is that if we move a fair amount of air, we can reduce the particles very quickly, and with 12 air changes an hour, we get a 99% reduction in particles in about 23 minutes, and that dilution ventilation is very useful in getting rid of odors as well as particles that are generated in the hospital environment. And we do generate a lot of particles, so we have to be careful how we judge them, especially if the particle count or real-time analysis is available. And, of course, filtration. We want the air to be purified, and that's nicely done if the filters are properly installed. So how do we use temporary negative pressure today? We use it during construction. Again, this is voila. It's the way it is. If we've got good barriers, we can contain. We certainly also use it for infectious disease isolation, those diseases where we house temporarily and we have hold opens on our doors when we're not used, and as soon as we close that door with the way the ventilation is set up, we have containment. And that's good. That's what we want, even though it might only be temporary. And then, of course, if we have to, there will be times when we may need to think about that surge, that group of patients showing up that potentially could be infectious, hopefully with something that we can manage quite readily, but because of that uncertainty, we're going to react and try to get them in place. What we're really striving for is to make sure that we have negative pressure isolation when we need it. Those negative pressure isolation can be rooms, and so often in our hospitals they are more permanent. What makes them temporary is the door open. When we close the door, it works quite well. But we can set up these rooms very easily. We can set up areas for surge very easily simply by doing some manipulation with fans and windows. We can take out windows and we can exhaust that area, and that would be one way that we could take a certain portion of the hospital and set it aside for that if infectious disease event, if a covey of infectious patients comes, of infectious disease patients comes walking in through the door, and we need to isolate them in a hurry. And then, of course, we can do local isolation. We can have a temporary setup, and we have used that when we've needed to get patients out of rooms during construction projects because of the noise. We can set up a small clean area somewhere for or even a dirty area to contain the patients in an effort, again, to keep those microbes from floating around. The next slide, what to validate. We want to make sure we have airflow direction, clean to dirty. And we need to understand when the patient is clean and when the patient is contaminated, and I'm sure that is self-evident in how we're approaching this presentation. And then when we look at the ways that we can create temporary negative pressure isolation with a portable filter, the algorithm that you see pretty much on slide 17 shows the various types of negative pressure isolation. as it relates to how we would exhaust to the outside, how we could potentially return the air locally to purify it because we can't get to an outside wall, or in some instances we may need to isolate for a short period of time. One example of that would be in our smaller hospitals in this state, we do not have isolation rooms, and those patients are transported to mother hospital where they would have better supply of isolation rooms or ones that are functioning, and they would wait for transport, and we would set up potentially a temporary area, which can be plastic and duct tape, in order to deal with that. What we can get, again, this is available to you online. Paul has mentioned it in previous teleconferences, W's and Merit, umn.edu. That website has a booklet available for those of you who would like that deals with some of this barrier business, and certainly it's available to you, as well as a training program certificate for how to design and how to utilize some of the equipment that we're talking about. When we want to discharge air to the outside, we certainly take select a room, set up a pre-constructed window adapter, if in fact that's what we're going to use, and we do this often. We do this anytime we have major projects. We have different phases of the projects, and certainly it's that practice in setting up which we would employ from our carpenters if, in fact, we had a situation where we needed rooms for infectious disease patients. We certainly created an airflow into the patient room while extracting that filtered air out the window, and something, again, that we can set up fairly quickly if, in fact, it has to be done. And we do set them up fairly quickly as we progress with the many construction jobs that we have going on right now. Discharging on the next slide to the return air system is another way. We certainly can put air into the return ducts. We don't want to overpressurize them and blow air in elsewhere because it can mess up some of the ventilation patterns that we have. But we can also just recirculate the air locally as a means by which, again, if during a construction project you're generating an aerosol, that we can create negative pressure at the same time we are containing those particles, which might be problematic in that particular work environment. Slide 20, then, is the next slide that we have, and there we look at the proof of containment. The barriers for containment must show a pressure differential. Visually, that means pulling that. We should be able to see the plastic get pulled in, and that's what we want. We can additionally, if we have rigid barriers, we can use a differential pressure check with a digital pressure gauge, some kind of a readout. Some people use smoke sticks, but there should be a way at your institution to validate that. Likewise, how do we validate mechanical control? That airflow intensity, again, is what we're trying to translate. And in this case, when we have airflow intensity, it's in the form of pressure. It's not in pounds per square inch, it's more in the velocity at which that air travels in the direction where it's biased by the exhaust and supply. So we certainly want to be able to generate a pressure differential because that keeps those aerosols from moving about in areas that we don't want them to move. Likewise, the filtration part of it, it's the physical removal of particles. I think we've discussed filtration theory in previous presentations that I've done for Paul, and one that, again, if the filters are not properly installed, like you see in these Pennsylvania filters, they blow out. In this particular situation, the filters got wet. The pre-filters got wet, drew a huge vacuum because the airflow wouldn't go through. There was condensation in the fan chamber. The filters got wet, and it blew out. I've seen this happen many times. Some Canadian hospitals, I've seen this happen. So we certainly need to be mindful that it crosses borders and is more common than I hate to tell you how common it is, but one that we we really need to pay some attention to, especially if you're starting a major construction project outside the building and you've got oncology patients inside. Why do we validate? We want to demonstrate the existing conditions. We want to make sure that things are working properly, and that is important for construction as well as if we have to react to something that's improper from an infectious disease point of view. We want area control. Our first and foremost goal, any kind of ventilation system, is to maintain comfort and manage the moisture. If we don't manage the moisture, it will grow something, and that often is mold, and that creates all kinds of excitement in people, even though the majority of us are not susceptible, perhaps allergic-wise, but not susceptible to mold infection or fungal infections from that point of view. Fire management, again, is a very important part of any construction and isolation during that time, because it's important to contain that smoke if it should happen to start a fire. Infection control, again, is involved with airborne spread infectious diseases. We want to be able to respond to those unknown infectious patients if ever they should show up, and that construction aerosol can be potentially infectious in those patients that are neutropenic, but it's a perception issue that really causes a lot of problems. I've seen an operating room carts just covered with dust. While most of it's chalk dust, would it be infectious? I don't know. Would it cause a lesion in a wound? Yeah. It would cause all kinds of potential problems because we can see it. And those environmental microbes, while they're different, some of them can take advantage of us from an opportunistic point of view. In the next slide, we see some of the crazy things that we end up seeing in hospitals. And in the case with the guy with the air hammer, the jackhammer, he's generating a tremendous aerosol as they're taking out the radiology wall, again, to expand that particular part of the facility into something else. That aerosol that's generated is mostly calcium dust, one that generates a lot of concern. Why? Because you can see it, and the noise is bothersome too. So the challenge there is a perception of keeping that under control, whereas the other slide on this, another picture on this slide, is one where we discovered what happens when you don't take all the moisture out of the air in the dish room. It grows a lot of mold. And in this particular case, we discovered and we need to contain a very significant source of mold in our kitchen area, where the cafeteria feeds many patients, visitors, who then go to patients' rooms, and we have a large bone marrow facility, so it became a very big deal for us. Containing that, again, is a big part of it. How do we validate the containment with particle counters? We certainly want to be able to demonstrate that we have a reduction in those numbers. That reduction generally should correspond to the reduction in particles greater than 0.5 microns in size. And we do that by validating across the filter bank or from the diffusers in the patient rooms compared to outside. It's a quality check. The standards that are there, we don't follow is if you consider the International Standards Organization, because operationally hospitals have people, lots of people. There's lots of movement, so the particle counts are inconsistent. That's why the best time to check often to validate that the ventilation is working is when nothing's going on. But again, you want to be able to demonstrate that in some way, because that's the objective information. And those of you from the states that deal with the Joint Commission, these are the data, some of the data I provide to them when they walk in and ask us what we're doing to protect our patients from Aspergillus, and that has happened the last go-round. Interpretation of the data, again, we're dealing with rank order, we're dealing with indoor-outdoor ratios, particle size, and then is the construction zone or infectious disease zone different from the clean area? And those are all things that we can discover utilizing the particle counter. And again, I have discussed this in previous shows that Paul has available to you online. The pressure gauge tool on the next slide can be used to test a location. We can see the intensity of that airflow. We certainly want to make sure that it's intense enough so it doesn't reverse that airflow. But the interpretation should be based on what's clean and what's dirty. And in order for us to establish safety, we want a certain pressure, and that relates to the velocity of that particular tool. Whenever we're testing the air for particles in the fan system, we take a particle counter and we put it above and below the filter bank to let us have some indication of the integrity of that filters or the group of filters that are in that particular system. It has been very successful in the past. If you look at the Saravia paper that was cited earlier, you'll see that somewhere in the vicinity of 80 to 90% of the filters that we checked, the filter banks we checked, did not meet that at least 80% reduction in particles before and after the filter. Why? Because, again, a lot of times people buy wrong size filters, and American Society for Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers, ASHRAE, is actually coming up with a test method for evaluating filters that are installed in fan systems. The next slide shows an example of a sample log that we took from the little booklet that you can get online. That sample log demonstrates, again, the sampling before with over 12,000 particles per cubic foot, and then after the filter, which is a very efficient filter at 99% reduction with 40 particles. This isn't exactly the best way of doing the test in the sense that we should sample many locations, but this is a very good way of determining whether or not your filters are installed. And my rule of thumb is that once it starts getting below 80%, 75% in reduction, there might be something wrong in there, and that was often the case when I opened up those filter banks. And the next slide shows a ventilation checklist. Again, that ventilation checklist has to do with airborne infection isolation rooms. Certainly, if we don't have windows closed, they won't work. If the doors are propped open, they won't work. If the alarms need to be functioning, and there needs to be certain things in place that give us what we need to know, are the pressure readings appropriate? Often, we check our pressure readings with the wall-mounted digital pressure gauge with a handheld digital pressure gauge because we know that the wall-mounted ones do plug up with lint with time, and if we don't pay attention to the cleaning of those pressure gauges, sometimes they become non-functioning, and that can cause some concern in employees. How to assure isolation ventilation parameters? Again, those fixed rooms make a big difference. We get a high volume of air moving when we have that dilution ventilation. We talked about those air change rates, and that little graphic that you see on slide 29 is a depiction of that reduction that I've talked about. It's important, again, to move air because that really helps us in diluting out those particles. And if we capture them and control the airflow direction, either with a portable filter or a fixed room, we certainly have what it takes to figure out what we need for safety in that infectious process. Determining air changes per hour, again, 60 minutes times the airflow and whatever volume, cubic meters per minute over the room volume, you can get your air change rate for those of you who might want to challenge their calculations for doing this. Is something we should know. I'm proud of the fact that our construction contractors have formulas like this that they determine how many portable filters they need to exhaust a space. So it is useful information. And in the next slide, if we don't validate our air balance, making sure that our supplies and returns are what they say they are on the design sheets, the blueprints that come out, we really don't have a clue. We really need to make sure, validate these things with some kind of objective information using the tools that we've been talking about, the balancing hood, the pressure gauge, and the particle counter. We need to seal the room to make it work. What is a sealed room? These are all definitions, again, that we're working on today. A sealed room is one which doesn't have excessive amount of exfiltration or infiltration, the key word meaning excessive. What does that mean? So we need to really be able to have a performance standard for our airborne infection isolation rooms, our areas where we deal with infectious patients, and by doing some of the things that we're talking about, measuring pressure and doing some calculations, we achieve that control. The surge capacity control on slide 22 or 32 really gives us an opportunity to isolate larger areas. The pictures show anterooms. Those anterooms are very useful in a variety of situations that allow for a movement of material in and out in hard-to-control pressurized areas. And the depiction that you see with a portable filter as part of the barrier makes it easier to accomplish that task. We just need to know how we're going to blow the air and what conditions we want to preserve. And again, studying the airflow and knowing which is clean and which is dirty really goes a long way for understanding airflow direction and how we would want to set it up for particular conditions. And again, that's up to you. You know what your hospitals are like. Your smaller hospitals aren't going to have nearly the concern, unless, of course, something crazy happens, like one hospital where the slab on the hospital dropped 4 inches in the operating rooms, which caused a great deal of concern. How we set up the barriers in that operating room condition was critical for making sure that they could keep two ORs open while one was being repaired. A small community hospital in the rural part of my state has a great need for that hospital, so keeping those operating rooms open is really an important part of the community process. But if we didn't have good barriers, if we don't have good pressure management, regardless what kind of barrier we put up, we're not going to have the infection control and prevention that we need when the time comes. Of course, the physician showed up right away after that and said he'd operated in that hospital for the last 15 years, and he's never had an infection until today. So, you know, if you don't have something to show them that demonstrates that you're working properly, he might think that staphylococcal infection was truly from the construction project and not from some technique issue that may have occurred. So these monitoring devices we utilize, the fact that we can demonstrate really alleviates the risk and some of the concerns that we hear from people. We need to be in control, and it, regardless if you use a ping pong ball, a cheap flutter strip with a hole in it and paper fluttering in there, you don't have any evidence that things are working properly. In this evidence-based world, we want to be able to demonstrate. Portable filters work. In the next slide, we certainly can utilize them for temporary isolation, creating those barriers to put indoors, like they negotiated yesterday with me in our central sterile processing. And again, we should utilize them because that dust that's generated, while majority of it's nuisance, it does raise a great deal of concern for people. That emerging infectious disease, again, surge capacity criteria, this is well documented. It's in the booklet. The training modules are there, and certainly please take advantage of it. For your purposes, and hopefully it can be utilized for the construction project that's headed your way, I'm sure. Those smoke zones, again, are natural areas in hospitals. You've got them in Canada. We've got them in the States. They're good areas to utilize when thinking about infectious diseases in large numbers or even to isolating part of the hospital during a construction project. We can do that by a variety of ventilation systems. We can get contaminated air out of the building by taking out windows or the slide 38. We can actually build little side branches of ventilation that will help us to discharge that air to the outside when and if we need it. Again, this is a common practice and one that we must utilize during construction as well as we can utilize if, in fact, that disease event comes our way. Essential ventilation parameters, you've heard me say this before, you get one air change. If it's good mixing, you get 66% reduction. When we deal with pressure, pressure doesn't come across as pounds per square inch, but actually comes across as a velocity. So if we have an air velocity of 0.25 pascals or a thousandth of an inch, we're moving air at about 100 to 120 feet per minute. At a hundredth of an inch, we're moving air somewhere around 400 feet per minute. Again, that's a very rapid airflow and one that, of course, translates to pressure. The tenth of an inch a water gauge, again, translates to a very high velocity, and that very high velocity actually can become a nuisance, so a sound, so we don't want to go to those super high velocities, again, as we're dealing with pressure management. We can do a very good job of controlling particles when we have somewhere in the vicinity of 7 pascals or somewhere right around 0.03 of an inch water column. Keeping that leakage under control is a big part of it, as well as making sure that our filters are installed and particle reduction is occurring because the filter process is in place. So all very important essential parts of ventilation control. Peggy here is checking one of our portable filters that's part of a barrier in a construction project in our neonatal ICU a few years ago, validating to make sure that filter is working properly. I saw a couple today that look like they've been thrown around by gorillas, so I might have to go over and make sure that, in fact, those filters are working the way that they are supposed to. The last slide in this series has to do with where to get the training modules. You're welcome to them. And as we move into sanitation, we certainly want to remember that ring of infection, that breaking that chain is really the key to infection control. And we do need to think about sanitation practice during patient care. How we validate sanitation is a tricky part because so often we use real-time visual versus culturing. Culturing takes time, and it's been 3 days since you cultured. It becomes meaningless information unless you're doing a research project. Real-time visualization of the surface and perhaps even odor are what we tend to utilize in validating sanitation. But what we can begin to talk about is that surrogate analysis, and we'll be coming up on that momentarily. We certainly want to compare correlations. We want contact time with the bio load. We certainly, the more we get exposed to bio load, the more problems we have. And certainly that chemical inactivation is a big part whenever we're doing sampling because we may end up with false negatives, under those circumstances. For slide 43, again, is training. We should understand what to do. We get mold growing in a variety of locations when the temperature and humidity are correct, the water content is correct. And on the bottom picture, we certainly are seeing our share of environmental contamination due to backed up toilets. It's something that happens, unfortunately, with some regularity, and one that we expect our employees to be trained. In their best efforts, sometimes they get mixed up and think that what we see Manny standing on the toilet, the bugs that we're dealing with there are not airborne spread, but are contact spread, and we need to know how to manage that. I responded to that flood that you saw with Manny standing on the a toilet stool, and so that made me curious, and so I went to our maintenance department. And the next slide, 44, I requested that they do a search on water-related incidents for 1 year, November of 06 to November of 07, and what we found was 1,364 water events. we had over 600 plugged toilets, showers plugged, showers leaking, sinks leaking. All of this kind of water can not only lead to mold growth, but when you think about the C. diff and the VRE and the norovirus potentially, the C. diff is by far more common, that's in that water, we really begin to worry about it. And when you have 71 of those events on bone marrow with plugged sinks and toilets, you begin to wonder what the root cause of that particular problem is. Those diseases that we can get that are related to our emerging infectious disease profiles, we certainly need to be fully aware that especially those, pardon me, poop bugs can be particularly problematic, and we need to think about how that is coming about. And quite frankly, it's because of the wipes, certain wipes that are not toilet paper, but of a microfiber that become very difficult to disintegrate in the bath, in the flow of the wastewater. It gets caught in our cleanouts. As it gets caught in the cleanouts, Roto-Rooter or whoever's snaking that out pushes it into a larger pipe, and that larger pipe this last weekend was a 6-inch pipe. It got stuck in a turn. This wad of wipes, it backed up huge when many toilets all flushed at once on the east side of our building, and we had a monster flood in our radiology as well as our emergency department. Those events are can be a real source of problematic microbes that can move around. Likewise, there are some patient events that cause problems when we vomit. It's captured in basins. What are those bugs coming out of that individual's mouth? They can create environmental contamination. Likewise, fecal matter on our urinary tract appliances, as well as an environmental contamination from those backed up toilets, can present local reservoirs. And of course, blood presents itself with its own unique problem. So what we need to think about a little bit is that those definitions, sanitized to reduction in microbial contamination to safe levels, disinfection, again, inactivation of those pathogens, recognizable pathogens, but not necessarily eliminating spores. And, of course, sterilize. I have a hard time with the word sterilize because that's essentially destruction of all microbial life, and that is not that easy to do. So we want to reserve sterilization for when we really sterilize something in the operating rooms for implants and that kind of thing. But the rest of our world really revolves around sanitization and disinfection. And we have to have contact time. That D value is the time of a disinfectant required to reduce that microbial population to 1/10 its number, or one log reduction. All, again, very important terms because they require that we need to get some sanitation that involves consistent daily cleaning that removes that contamination and deals with it appropriately. Again, some surfaces seem to be off limits in hospitals, a bed rail, for example. We'll start talking about that momentarily. And we do need to think about how we can manage those environmental events, be it the vomitus, the stool on the floor, or potentially that stuff coming out of the toilet like it did. The last big flood came out of a nuclear medicine sink that backed up big time and flooded that particular part of the hospital this last weekend. And those are those plumbing-related events that we see in my place quite often. If you looked in yours, I bet you'd be surprised too. So we need to deal with sanitation practice. That's real disease management. We need to be able to know what we're doing, and that comes with reviewing what you've got in hand. What are those guys doing when they go out and rod a toilet that's been backing up? We need to know, and they need to understand, because that day-to-day application of this stuff is what keeps it from spreading around. Do the housekeepers actually follow the plumber into the room afterwards, or is nursing required to clean up the stool on the floor in front of the nurse station? And then the nurse, the housekeeper comes afterwards. Did they really get it? So we need to be able to have a way of managing those sorts of things. And the infectious The infectious agent on the surface, the sanitization of that surface, a surface really needs to be decontaminated. It's just that we need to validate that cleaning, and we can't be able to do that with culture methods. So body waste management, there are many ways that many people get, come in contact with the patient. I watched my loved one vomiting and daughters taking care of her a few months ago. And, you know, I could see that their fingers were getting splashed on. Did they clean off the handle when they rinsed out the emesis basin? I doubt it. Again, a classic example of how bugs can get into the patient room and we inadvertently pick it up. We need to be able to know what we're cleaning and how well we're cleaning it, and certainly the sanitation is a big part of that, and preventing that environmental splatters on hands and clothing are all challenges that are very difficult to even comprehend. But we want to talk about what we can comprehend, and that's how to validate. As we said before, we generally rely on visual. Then we go to culture, but culture takes time and becomes a meaningless process. But what we're doing and what we did this weekend is utilize real-time technology, this adenosine triphosphate technology, to measure cleaning, sanitation. There are a couple of methods out there. There are a couple of companies that make these. I'll let you discover those. Where they are, but they are available to us, and it's becoming more popular. The next slide has to do with Krebs cycle, the whole glycolysis, and the development of ATP. It's in all living creatures. We have an ability to attach an enzyme to that called luciferase that combines and emits light. And when we swab a surface, such as a toilet handle, we can take from that surface microbes, which then are lysed with the specialized culturette, and we can then put it in a photometer, like you saw in the previous slide, and with that, we can determine the bioload of that particular surface. A very useful process, one that we began evaluating at our institution some months ago, and we're currently in the middle of some studies today looking at that. And the study I want to describe to you is one that we had my student Mark Galvin go out and have some have a look at the bed rail, supply cart, keyboard, flush handle, and door handle in patient rooms. When you use this test, there's a method that you have to follow, and the way that you handle this swab-like apparatus, I'll let you read that. You apply downward pressure. You find a pattern that you move it back on so that you can develop a technique so it's consistent from one a test site to another. And again, it ends up in giving off a light. Once you lyse the cells and put it into this photometer, it gives off a short burst of light called a relative light unit. And with that, you'll see a chart of the audit that we did, which we're beginning to get ready to publish, where we looked at the relative light units of these various areas in the hospital, a bed rail, the keyboard, treatment cart, doorknob, and a flush handle. And you can see the bed rail and the bathroom doorknob were by far the highest. We're looking at those now with additional ATP technology, as well as trying to determine if we pick up any C. diff off of those surfaces at the same time. And you can see in the range of the relative light units that there's a big difference in just the total numbers. We see that those discharged rooms have generally less than 500. It was our standard. This is written in some papers. We are seeing that the discharged rooms, again, those rooms that are clean before occupancy, demonstrate satisfactory levels compared to those extremes that we see. And those are the fascinating ones. You've heard me talk about this in mold management. It's the burst that we're concerned about. And are we seeing, in fact, here a burst, or in other words, a missed spot? This tool is very useful in training housekeepers. It's being utilized at our institution today for training housekeepers, and that truly is a good goal for a device such as this to be able to evaluate the environment real time and to provide feedback. The next slide, again, some pretty pictures, some pretty histograms of occupied and discharged. Their goal, again, is to recognize surfaces and then to be able to clean them in a way that gets the numbers down. And of the 500 relative light unit standard came from an article by Griffith in the Journal of Hospital Infection in 2007. And again, it's a useful way in which we have been able to demonstrate to our housekeepers where they need to do the cleaning in our facility. We checked a variety of locations in our bone marrow transplant, our medicine ICU, a transplant station, sort of a normal ward, med-surg ward, and then neurology. It's quite a difference in cleanliness. It may not look like it much on that log scale of discharged room relative light units, but in fact, the least clean was the neurology, perhaps because of the lack of intensity. Likewise, again, the audit of the bed rail cleaning in an occupied and discharged room, there's quite a range difference. And that range difference, again, is what we're looking at because the bed rail is such a hard thing to keep clean. It's probably the most difficult simply because it can be recontaminated within seconds after cleaning it. How do we take care of the bed rails? How do we deal with that? We'll take some innovation. Some people have thought of metal ions, some kind of residual disinfectants on the surfaces. There are a variety of ways that people are thinking on how they can best control them. But we know good and well that if we scrub it and wipe it down every couple minutes, that would probably be the best way, but yet a bed rail would be awfully intensive for that reason alone. So again, why is body substance there? Cleaning so inconsistent? Why is that? Why do we have troubles with that? Is it because standard precautions have made us lax? Is it because there are multiple caregivers, again, visitors, and so on? And then again, who actually responds to the cleanup? Sometimes it's the visitor, sometimes it's the healthcare worker. They don't have time housekeeping, so you can see how we can get into an inconsistent means by which we clean up these infectious disease sources. We should develop alert plans. Vomit alert, how do we do with that? Regardless which alert plan you may have, we should always think of things as a two-step process. One, to get rid of the organic material, the so-called debris. The other one is to use an appropriate disinfectant. And again, the name of the game in the hospital is disinfectant, where we might sanitize something at home. We commonly think of disinfection in the healthcare facility. So that two-step process is important, and I've seen that particular aspect fall by the wayside. It's generally done with one step, clean it up and run. And if even if you read some of the disinfectants, they talk about one step. We cannot use bleach effectively unless you get rid of all the organic material. So that two-step process, removing the debris, organic material, and then disinfecting is really the critical part. So that's why we have the body substance issue slide. Two steps for cleanup. The disinfectant should be hospital approved. A chlorine or chlorine compound. Steam works good for some of these microbes, such as norovirus. And unfortunately, some folks are thinking that gas fumigation might be the way to go. Now, I'm not convinced that vaporized hydrogen peroxide or chlorine dioxide or even propelled alcohol, I think it's isopropyl alcohol or ethanol with carbon dioxide propellant are good things. There's a problem with immediate danger to health and life being somewhere right around 75 parts per million with chlorine dioxide. How do you use that when there's a patient on the other side of that wall? I don't know. They seem to think that they can do that without safety issues, but yet I would venture a guess that we would not want to try something like that. Besides, it takes two steps. You have to clean the room first before you can fumigate it. So gas fumigation does not look like a viable aspect at this stage, even though I know hospitals are trying to get into that as a means by which they can eradicate some of these environmental scourge microorganisms. Where to disinfect? Who reports a discharge? Who cleans it up? And who disinfects? Again, housekeeping generally does that, but sometimes when we get in a hurry to reoccupy, that can fall by the wayside. You should give training to respective caregivers. What do hospital employees do for body discharge? And again, do we treat it all infectious, or is some vomit that's considered not? I don't want to make that distinction. I think it should be all treated the same. That's a universal precaution. But yet we become more lax with those universal precautions. Perhaps we should treat body substances differently when it comes to vomit or even stool. So we need to be able to think about how our visitors and our family responds to that, and what do they need to know if they are providing some of the care to their loved ones while they're staying in the hospital. Hospital and housekeeping and maintenance response, how they disinfect after sewage backup is key. And again, disinfection after they clean out a toilet plug. These are all questions we're asking our people now, and again, it's that emphasis on contamination management and what we've touched, which become really important factors. Again, your reaction to cleaning might even prevent that spread of the microorganism, and certainly that's important. Should we do something for an infectious body substance? Certainly, if we know they're in isolation, we're going to do something, but should we treat all of that symptomatic discharge, body discharge, the same? These are tough questions for me to answer because I don't take care of patients, and it's that nurse that's responsible, or the individual that's responsible for dealing with it on the day-to-day basis that really requires that cleanliness verification. We certainly want to demonstrate that we have compliance with hand washing. We've talked a little bit about air quality and demonstrate comparison of air quality using real-time analysis or even culture analysis, and we covered that in previous sessions as well as a teeny bit here today. Surfaces, we would like to be able to demonstrate cleaning, and now I think with this ATP technology, we can demonstrate cleaning real-time without having to bother our micro labs with culture technology. And training, of course, demonstrate and understand the competencies for cleanliness. I think the training with some of this real-time analysis is really going to be very useful in reducing surface contamination in our hospitals, and with that incident management of those infectious diseases, we really want to be able to have consistent body fluid cleanup, again, from patient caregiver to the visitor, the maintenance plumbers, and the plumbers as well as housekeeping. All are very important in dealing with this, and of course, if we continue to throw our wipes in the bathroom that aren't soluble into the toilet, we end up with backup. And this week there's some serious discussions in nursing administration about the impact of this huge flood that we had and whether or not those wipes will be banned. Some people say just do it right. I don't know why we can't, but maybe that's a cultural thing here in my neck of the woods. My last slide, water and air sanitation. Again, water problems can come at you fast. We've seen that happen in a number of situations where we've broken pipes in cardiac catheterization lab. I remember that particular response. Again, we had to dry it out and clean it quickly. Good thing that particular flood was clean water. But when it gets into that gray and black water, we do need to seriously consider how we're going to sanitize the surfaces. And if we don't get at it soon enough, that nitrogen in that icky water will end up growing something, and it grows quite quickly when there's nitrogen there. So air quality can deteriorate without your even knowing it, and that's why those filters should be maintained. We should have preventative maintenance in place, because We don't even know many times when our air quality becomes bad because of uncontrolled construction, uncontrolled mold source being released into the local environment. So again, planning provides for that sustainability, for comfort and infection control, and that's why we like to have our hospitals well-maintained, well-designed, again, for those purposes. So I managed to get through this with only going 3 minutes over the presentation. I hope it's been of value to you. And on the first slide, I have my email address. If you have any pressing questions, please give me a drop me a line, and I'll try to get back to you as soon as I possibly can. Thank you.
Andy, thank you. Thank you again for another outstanding and information-packed lecture. I don't know how you managed to get all of that in there. It's a good thing you talk fast. And folks, if you'd like to get to know Andy a little bit better, if you have a problem at your facility, I don't have permission to say this, but I know that he's been to a lot of places. In fact, anywhere that I say, oh, you should meet Andy Streifel, they often say, well, we've had him over to our facility. It's a great experience to have Andy visit you, because his eyes look places and see things that others just don't. On the very last,
I don't have very many friends for that reason.
Thanks, Andy. It's another great teleclass lecture, and I'm looking forward to more of the same. So to all, until we meet again, goodbye.